Blog Talk Radio.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Well, stop and it's done, and I'm gonna do it right. Till I get to the bottom, and I see you again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But do you, don't you want me to love you?
I'd like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight, and our special guests are John and David Timmons of the Timmons Brothers. You can go on their website, timmonsrock.com. Tonight's show is about the Beatles' White Album, the 50th anniversary celebration. Released on November 22, 1968, the Beatles became the first full album to follow Sgt. Pepper's A Lonely Hearts Club Band. which had been released some 18 months earlier in June of 67. A multiple number of events occurred in this interim: the death of Brian Epstein, the trip to India, the start of the Apple Corporation, and the tumultuous year of 1968, political cultural events that affected the Beatles as a band and their music. The Timmons Brothers will analyze, explore, and celebrate the upcoming 50th anniversary of the album that has become known as the White Album and its place in history of rock and roll and the legacy of the Beatles. John and David, welcome to the show.
Hey, good. How you doing, John?
John, that is quite an opening song, I must say. If anybody was asleep, I think they are now awoken.
You know what I like about that song, too? That is after the Who made the comment that the Beatles was getting soft. And you could tell they showed the Who that we're not getting soft. I tell you, it was very electric.
Yeah, and it has for DJs, it has like two or three fake endings in it. So that's always a lot of fun. Yeah, you got it. Oh, okay, so you watch your meter to see when the minutes are up. But thank you so much, guys, for being on the show tonight. Tonight we're going to have an hour show with John and David. This will be our part one. And then we're going to have a part two of this same show so we can cover all the different things. This is one of the most exciting shows, one of the ones that I think is just incredible, because if you look back at 1968 and you kind of think of all that was happening in the world of the Beatles and what they accomplished in that year by writing and recording and releasing this album, is unbelievable. It's one of those things where it's kind of hard for me to, how can someone do that within one, pretty close to a year period of time? And we're going to talk about that tonight. And if you have any calls or questions or comments, you can call in at 877-694-5613, and John and David will answer your questions, and we'd love to hear your comments on the Beatles' 50th anniversary of the White Album. So where do we start, guys?
I'll tell you, John, that's almost hard to amaze me. How do you top Sergeant Pepper? And here they are. They had 18 months in between, and you talk about an iconic album, but I think the key thing on this one here, with Big White, we see each Beatle as his individual, what there would be later. You can tell which direction they was going to, and basically you're going to see a big difference between John and Paul, and what songs they like to do. And basically, it'd be to tell us what they would do later down the road.
What do you think, John?
John, I want to say something, and there's probably some listener out there about ready to call in and say, hold on here, Magical Mystery Tour was in between, but we said the first full album. Magical Mystery Tour was actually only an EP of six songs in England, and they happened to, in American edition, made it a full album by taking songs that had been made during the Sergeant Pepper era, like Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever. So it
right.
was the first full album to follow Sergeant Pepper. So I know you knew it and Dave knew it, but in case there's somebody out there thinking, wait, they're wrong, you know. And I think that it's important, as you said right there at the introduction, to think of what was going on at the time. That trip to India, it was so critical to shaping what this album would become and the individuals they would become. I think they, of course, George was the one that really took it to heart when he went to India and met with the Maharishi and as far as the meditation. But John was there the second longest for 3 weeks, and John had a lot of free time. And I was reading where he had gotten so much into the meditation and relaxing during the day, he couldn't sleep at night, so he developed this kind of insomnia, and that's why led to that song, I'm So Tired. And he hated it because at night then he'd wake up in the middle of the night and just start working on another song. And I think he actually wrote something like 15 songs that end up being recorded while he was there. And that's just the ones that he wrote, not including the ones he might have collaborated with McCartney.
That's when, well, he came up with that Dear Prudence during his time and everything. The one I like about, though, there was one guy in their group, he was from America, and he wanted to go tiger hunting, and John Lennon grabbed his acoustic guitar and came up with Bungalow Bill and about going hunting. And the India trip, another key thing about India, they realized the Ringo and Paul hated the food. And we find out later, I believe, hey, am I right on this, John? I think Ringo leaves first because he didn't like what they all ate there.
That's my understanding, yes.
Yes, and so it's a different a thing. And then, of course, the Maud Roger made a pass at all their wives, too. So they found out he wasn't perfect.
Yeah, no one is. One of the things I think is interesting, too, about this, guys, is that when you had the Beatles and they were breaking ground and they were making music that no one else was making, they were doing things in the studio with sound and things that all the other, the Rolling Stones, the Who, the Beach Boys, everybody was trying to catch up with them. And they were listening to their first three or four albums and Revolver and Rubber Soul, and they were like blown away. Everybody was thinking, you know what? We're never going to catch up with these guys. They're just too good, but we keep trying. So they kept working and working. And then, like David said, then Sgt. Pepper comes along, and then they just all throw their instruments down and think, well, there's no way we can compete with this. What is this? This is something from another world. We can't even – we don't know where these guys are coming from. And then I think you said, John, and David, how do you, as a band, you've already – it kicked a 99-yard field goal. No one else can do it. They're all looking at each other like, what do we do now? We have to get it in the studio. We're trying to figure out Revolver. Now they come out with Rubber Soul, or then they come out with Sgt. Pepper, or it was the other way around. But then they're all just – I really think that the creative people, the Moody Blues, all these people, were thinking, okay – there's two different leagues. The Beatles are in one, and all of us are in another one. And then when
that's a good point.
And then when Sgt. Pepper was blowing everyone out, they're all in their little studios like little wizards, working so hard to get music to sound like that. And then the Beatles think, oh, okay, how about this? And then they come out with this double album full of music that it's incredible. I mean, to this day, I still – when I listen to it, guys, I feel like it's new music. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but it sounds fresh and new to me when I listen to it. It's like,
oh, hey, John, I agree. It never grows stale on you when you play it.
Yeah.
But you brought up some good points. Also, at this point in rock and roll history, groups like the Day Clark Five, the Animals, the Mercy Beats, Nam, cannot keep up with what's going on. They slowly start disappearing because they can't adapt to what is changing in the music scene at that time. And same way in the United States, there would be certain bands. So how can we top this now? And but then they influence, though, other bands. You could think about it, Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd
right.
was heavily influenced, especially when with Syd Barrett. If you
right.
listen to Emily, Emily says that song, it's very close to what the Beatles were doing. But like I said, 68 was such a turning point in rock and roll where either you survived or you were gone.
Yeah, the day of the three-chord rock and roll was pretty much gone at that point. I mean, it was still there, but it was at a point where they were in parts of the musical ocean that no one else could go to. And when I interviewed the band Klaatu, and I had them on the show, and I had all three members on the show, and I was talking to them about that, and they were talking to me about no one will ever get there. It was a renaissance, musical heaven opened up, light shined down, it hit those guys.
Yeah.
They wrote all this beautiful music, and it closed up, and everybody's scrambling around to try to figure out what was happening, what was going on. I know we have so much to talk about, but I know there was talk about LSD and Timothy Leary and all this
yes.
different things that were going on in their heads and expanding their minds and doing all this all these things. John, you made a point, I think it was, about George Harrison. One of you guys, he really bought into the Maharishi and to the meditation and to religion, where he had seen what drugs was doing to friends of his and family members, and he didn't want to be involved in that. And so he found a place in the spiritual world.
And I think a lot of that started with George. I don't know if it was absolute as far as the Genesis, but when he made that impromptu trip to Haight-Ashbury in summer of 67, when he saw all the strung-out kids on drugs, and that's when he decided that maybe it's time I give up this LSD, and he got underneath the microscope and saw all these little ropes and like, what am I doing to myself? That was when he quit that aspect. I think that was one of the big steps he took toward more of a mysticism, more of a spiritual approach.
And you think, too, John, when he met Ravi Shankar, that was a big influence of what he learned more about the Indian culture and learned about the sitar and stuff. And if you remember, they were experimenting with Indian instruments on revolver, basically, and a little bit on rubber sole. And George, though, I can remember later on in Anthology when they asked Paul McCartney later on about when George passed away, and Paul said he was at peace with himself even then. He knew what was going to happen, but he found contentment that he was always trying to find, and being a Beatle was never easy for George because they always called him the Quiet Beatle, but he was just as talented as Paul and John, but he was always in their shadow, but better off than Ringo, because at least Ringo always got his songs put on the refrigerator, so it's kind of rough on him.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that one thing I want to talk about also when we look at music, we also have to look at the art aspect, and we have to look at the album art, and we have to look at how that they were also, the Beatles, were way out in front of everybody with album art and with album design. And with Rubber Soul and with Revolver and all these things that were going on. Then they come out with this, with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, where you can still to this day, after 50 years, look at it and find something different on it. There's so many things going on. So they got that. John, kind of lead us into, okay, where do you go from here? Musically, I don't know where they were, where do you go from here? But also, how do you make an album cover that can compete with that? And what did they do?
Yeah, and I think that is so true, John, because probably their two most, as far as colorful albums, at least in America, was Sgt. Pepper, and then followed by the Magical Mystery Tour with all the animal masks and all the stars and rainbows bursting out. And, I read several accounts that there was different ideas being thrown around. I know for David, he's going to elaborate on one of the ideas, but one of them that had been talked about, the what would be the four pictures they would later insert into the album, maybe do a four-screen shot for the album cover. There was another one that, based on the author Henry Ibsen, The Doll's House, and have him having animal type of caricatures for a painting. And it's been used before, like on some bootlegs. You'll see it every now and then. And I actually have a Dutch import where they did use that as the album cover. So those were being floated around. And from what I understand, from what I read, and Dave, I'll let you talk because I know you have an example. I think that since they couldn't come together to agree on anything, so let's just make it really basic as basic can be. And can it get any more basic than embossing the group's name onto the cover and putting a number? Because I think that's what they did for the first hundreds or thousand, whatever, they actually was given a signed number on the album. And I want to point out, it was the first Beatles album on the new Apple label.
Well, right. George Martin, though, this was George Martin's fear. The Beatles always had at least their picture on the album or at least some symbols or something. The original plan was, and you'll see it inside the album, like their individual photos. But what they wanted to have was like a blue background with white, and this is, I did some research on this, with white clouds and each beetle looking down on the album itself. But John Lennon and Paul want as plain as it could be. And George Martin's concern was, he said, will fans buy this? Even though it's the Beatles, he was concerned that the, without a picture of the Beatles on there, and but if you're that talented, you're all right. But the original plan was like a blue setting with them looking down from the clouds, kind of make them look like rock and roll gods, I imagine. But I found this out by reading a book, a Beatle book from Japan. And that was, and Paul McCartney talked about this in one of his later interviews, and then they decided not to do it.
Dave, can I ask you a question? Because this is the first time I heard you talk about this, and I find it rather ironic. Think about the live album that the Plastic Ono Band would release about a year later with the white clouds and the blue background.
Yes. This is where this came from. John decided to go ahead and do that with the Plastic Ono Band, the blue sky, you're right, and the only difference is it would, and John liked that concept, but for some reason he, I think, cause Paul wanted to do it or something. But the point of this, John, you're right, and that's the way they was going to have them doing this. And it kind of surprised me. I did extra research on this, and it's amazing. And you wonder if they would have done this. And another big thing we got to talk about this. Another album without no singles on it, like Sgt. Pepper, which was a big gamble, which you got to be a major group at that time if you didn't have no singles from your album.
I believe that when you look at it from the perspective of the fans, guys, they didn't – I think what it was a tad bit of arrogance from the band thinking they don't care what our album covers look like. They could care less. They will buy the album, so don't worry about it. And we'll even prove it to you. We won't even put anything on the album, and they'll buy it. And that's exactly, I think, and that's exactly what happened. But didn't Led Zeppelin take it another level? They didn't put anything on one of their albums.
Exactly.
And then had the one had the paper bag, you know.
Yeah.
And
then
and
they
you,
had the old man pulling the cart, and there's always different things. But then again, you think of the Rolling Stones, Beggar's Banquet. No picture of the Stones on that one. And just if you remember, basically. So you got to be an iconic group to take that chance. There's some groups that couldn't have done that. I know Mott the Hoople couldn't have done it. I did it. They couldn't have, they had to have a picture cover.
You did it.
I have to tell David something. My cousin, I don't think I told you guys this, but my cousin, Marcia, called me about 3 weeks ago saying that someone in their family had gotten an album collection they wanted to get rid of, and they asked me if I wanted it. Did I tell you that?
No.
I don't know if I told you that. Yeah. Well, anyway, it's sitting here in front of me. And there's a couple of Ian Hunter and Samantha Hoople albums in that collection. I thought of David right away. I thought, oh, my.
Absolutely.
He's got to come over and see these. But
I
think – yeah, I agree with you to the point where it's like my buddies Klaatu did the same thing. They put an album out without anything on it, with no names, and without, you know, they didn't want – it was like when I talked to those guys, they said, we want people to listen to the music and buy the music, not caring who we are or anything about us. They like the music, they'll buy it. And I think with the Beatles, where they were so out there with the album covers and with the, all the – incredible ways to market the everything. Marketing was, they were always the best at that. Now,
they're just amazing.
Yeah, and then they would say, we're going to show you, we're going to blow your minds. We could put anything out there and people will buy it. And that's exactly what they did. So we got a caller here. Let's see what hi, do you have a question for the Timmons Brothers?
Yeah, this is Mike Burney. How you doing today?
How you doing,
hey, Mike?
Good. I do have a question. I just got in. I was at a meeting, but don't know if you talked about this. I heard something that in the song Julia that Ringo was gone. He had just quit for a little bit, and Paul actually played the drums. Excuse me for that set. Is that true?
That's true. Ringo got real disgusted because Paul kind of said he wasn't bringing in the drums like he wanted to, and Ringo said just walked out. And they, each Beatle, Mike had to send him apologize. Said we really missed. And George Harrison, when he did come back, had the room full of flowers. And I'll let John talk about a little bit about it too. But that was a true story.
Wow.
I think that all thought that nobody really cared what each other was doing anymore, and Ringo went around to each one individually to their house. There were three Beatles, and it's like, I don't feel wanted anymore. I saw it like, so it's you three against me. And George goes, oh, I thought it was you three against me. And the same with Paul when he went to Paul's house. He goes, I felt that it was you three against me. And then finally with John, so they all realized, like, hold on here. Who's against who?
Oh, paranoia, you know? In the group.
But the
paranoia
starting to happen in the group, Mike, basically, this would be the start of the tension they would have. And like John said, each one of them didn't know the other. But this was going to be – the Big White was a good album, but also you had a premises that down the road something was going to happen with the Beatles. You just had that feeling. We didn't know at the time, but the Beatles knew because – Yoko Ono even brought her bed to the studio, and that didn't help either. And so
yeah.
It got nasty.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you're right. You kind of feel the tension. I agree with you there in that album. So,
Mike, I want to share with you a quote from Ringo from the anthology book here. He says, Sgt. Pepper did its thing. It was the album of the decade, of the century, maybe. It was very innovative with great songs. It was a real pleasure, and I'm glad I was on it. But for me, the White Album ended up a better album. So even though Ringo walks out of the studio while they're working on the album, is not on some of the songs, he likes it better than in Sgt. Pepper. I don't know.
Huh.
That's wild. I've never heard that.
Yeah,
that's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Anything else, Mike?
No, I just really appreciate that. And guys, have a good evening. Appreciate our drink and always enjoy talking with you and listening to you.
Mike, remember this. Let's get the Raiders in the Hall of Fame in 2019.
Thank you.
All right.
And you're not talking about bye-bye. He's not talking about the Oakland Raiders either.
No, not the Oakland Raiders. For those listeners out there,
bye-bye.
If you don't know Dave and I, we've been pushing this for a long time, Paul Revere and the Raiders, yes.
That's it always. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks a lot. Well, guys, let's play a song. I was going to play Revolution. What do you think?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah. You know, we got several different variations of it. I think this one I think is going to be played is actually one from the White Album, which is different from the flip side single of when Hey Jude was released.
I got a story to tell a bit. Yeah.
To appease the big record label because they – go ahead, Dave.
That was – go ahead and tell what you're going to tell, and I'll tell Mike.
Okay. To appease the big record labels out there, they wanted Hey Jude to be released as a single. And so the Beatles did get it out because they knew it was going to take a little extra time to complete the White Album. And that's so you got kind of the raunchy version, I like to call it a revolution. Then you got more of almost a doo-wop sound of the revolution.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with that, and I still think that, you know, when you hear that song, that to me it says the Beatles all over it, but that's John Lennon all over it. That's,
I agree.
You know what I mean? It's like that wow, and just like if we have time, I want to play Obladi Oblada. That's Paul McCartney, all Paul McCartney. I know the other guys were in it, but don't you agree with that? That David, you said at the beginning of the show, their personality started to. Okay, now
oh,
you
definitely.
Had a band writing all this stuff. Now you've got, oh, here's John Lennon. He's heading towards, you know, the Plastic Ono Band and Elephant's Memory and all that stuff. And you got Ringo. He's starting to write. Well, he wrote this first song that was accepted. And when we went to hear him last week, he said when they did this song was on the White Album, he said that was – I had been writing songs my whole life, but that was the first song that they ever put on that I wrote. He said all the rest of them were just, you know, they said, well, we'll get back to them, and they never did.
Yeah.
So
they
ended
up on the refrigerator, probably. more likely. You know, but I want to bring up this one point before we listen to the song. George Martin wanted Revolution this virtual revolution put out on a 45, along with Why Don't We Do It on the Road? And that's another thing I found out in this Japanese Beatle book. The Beatles stopped it, and I think the 45 would have done well. They didn't want that, and so I just wanted to bring that up, which I think both of them would have done well as a single, though.
Yeah, I think at that point, the music was just speaking for itself. They didn't have to worry about any of that other stuff. It was like people loved their music, still do to this day. I wonder how many white albums are sold every day. It just probably would keep all of us rich. And because new people are listening to the music, kids are listening to it, thinking, oh my God, this is pretty good. Maybe my grandpa was right.
Yeah, I got to bring this up before we go to the song. I got to appreciate what John's does teaching that Beatle class down there. John will introduce them to the Beatle music. Some had never heard of them because I was down there lecturing one time. Hey, John, remember that one young girl said, I just thought Paul was in Wings and didn't even know about his second group. Remember that?
Yeah, before the class started, you're right.
Well, let's listen to it, yeah.
And actually, the White Album is the one that, John, you're talking about sales, how many gets sold every day. I can guarantee you, I've been teaching this course. I'll be getting ready to teach it for my fifth time. I guarantee every time I teach it, at least four or five people out of that class will have bought the White Album by the time the class ends, because it's like a self-discovery. Because there's so many songs they liked, they didn't realize, oh, they're from the White Album originally. Well, let me hear the rest of the White Album.
Yeah. It's incredible. Let's play it. Revolution. You're on John Talk Radio with John and David Timmons. Their website is timmonsrock.com. We're talking about the Beatles' White Album 50th anniversary. This is part one. We're going to have a part two. Just so much information, and plus John messed up the scheduling, John Darlington. And so we'll get to this is Revolution.
I think too.
We'll be right back.
Thank you. We're back with the Timmons Brothers, and this is John Talk Radio, and we are celebrating the White Album, the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' White Album, 1968 release. You want to know more about John and David? TheTimmonsRock.com is their website, and you can learn all about them there. We're talking about the Beatles' White Album. This will be part one. We'll have another one scheduled out there pretty soon, as soon as I get some dates out to the brothers, and they can pick out the date that works for them. And we'll put out a part two. Now, we played two songs that we talked about that were definitely the personality of those two guys. Lennon, very political. You want to help me, you know, we have no room for hate and all this. And there's Paul just kind of dancing around, you know, having fun, making music that's just goofy and it's just awesome. And if anyone out there is a bass player, if you hear his bass runs on Revolution, it's incredible. And Obladi is good too, but I mean he was doing things in with his bass playing that were just out of this world as a bass player. I just still to this day when I listen to it, I don't know how he did it, and I still don't know how he does it.
Hey John, I want to bring this up.
And he still does it.
Yeah, on this Obladi Wadaw, that would be one of the few songs that would be released as a single, and I believe I want to say about 1976, 1977 on the rock and roll album that had
That's
the Coca-Cola in it, and they released that as a 45 down the road, and I can remember it actually charted, and I think, hey John, am I right that this, I think that's the only single that ever came from that album, isn't it?
At least in the United States, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I think it was the rock and roll album, and every time I hear that, I want to dance a polka.
Yeah,
you know,
got quite a beat.
You know, John, when I'm listening to Obladi Wadaw, and you know, to set the tone, what we've been talking about, that you can see the individualities developing or have developed with the four Beatles. I'm just trying to picture what was John Lennon's face when Paul walks in the studio. Hey, here's the song we're gonna do. What do you think? You know, I
rolling his eyes.
What was Lennon's face?
Yeah, and
you know,
Yoko
the Beatles
right
all griped about that song, guys. They didn't even want to do Obladi Wadaw, and they said they bit their tongues and went through it because they thought it was too bubblegum-ish. And when John Lennon thought that, I like to see his face in the studio.
Yeah, he and Yoko, where she was right there with him. But
you mentioned Yoko. This was the first album that she was right down there with him in the studio, breaking that kind of the sanctity of, hey, it's just the guys. You don't bring your girlfriends, your wives in, and so we got all that going on as well.
Yeah, and also, John, I want to bring this up on the Revolution. One of the doo-wop guys was doing the doo-wops with him was Donovan Leitch. He'd happened to be there the same day that Paul was working on Blackbird, and Donovan, of course, had been to India with him, and Donovan, I read Donovan's biography, and he said he saw a whole different set of Beatles when we all got back from India, because he was on the Big White Sessions. He was there with them several times because he showed John Lennon the chords that needed to play for Dear Prudence. He wanted Donovan's style, how Donovan played his acoustic guitar. So basically, Donovan was, I think he was there with him for at least four or five songs.
Yeah, I believe you're right. And that whole the songwriting that went on, you know, I've got jotted down here, they wrote over 40 songs between them there in India. And it's just still to this day that just blows my mind. Not just that somebody could write 40 songs, but somebody could write songs like that. It's like,
oh, it's amazing.
I could write 40 songs, but I don't think it wouldn't be any good.
I know when John and I was in Razor's Edge, we was lucky to get two songs done in 3 months.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that they did what they did. And you made some great points at the beginning about Apple Corps, where they thought, okay, now we're gonna create this business, this multimedia business. How do you think that affected them, John, and the whole group and money and towards the decline, because you were, like you were saying at the beginning of the show, there were a lot of things. You had the India trip, you had Apple Corps starting up, you had Yoko coming in doing more. There was just so many things happening at that point in time. What do you think that had to do with it?
I think the Beatles in general thought there was going to be a kind of a utopian world, and they had so much faith and positivity about people, and that, you know, let's find the artist that is not getting seen, bring him in here, and we'll sign him, we'll give him that opportunity. And it was like thinking with the heart, not with the head, of the world of business. I think the intentions were good going into Apple Corps, but they didn't have the experience in the world of business. Brian Epstein is gone by then, who probably could have directed them in a much better direction with it.
Right,
and I do think that affected some of their songs, because they were so sort of jilted from the experience. And I think that would go into the Let It Be recordings, that experience, because by that point it is about ready to shut down as far as the, maybe not the recording part, but as far as the store and the boutique and things like that. And, you know, there's that famous picture of the guy who's the one-man band. It was an advertisement. It's like, you know, it was the Beatles that were appealing in the Melody Maker and other national publications. If nobody else will give you an opportunity, we will. Come to us, you know. And it was just so almost idealistic, but to the point of being sort of naive to the business real.
I like to bring up this point too. If Brian Epstein had lived, it would have been totally different, I think. I don't think you'd even had to break up the Beatles. Brian took care of all the business needs. They had no idea of the business side of music. They were songwriters. And I think right then, Epstein took that off their shoulders. And Brian Epstein also, no doubt, had to be a working band. And I do predict, this was, and John's always heard me talk about this at our Beatle things down at the university. I always thought if he lived, they would have toured again, and there wouldn't have been, and he would have let them all made solo albums. Let's get this out of your system, then we'll go back as a unit. But when you put business and music together, it don't match. And George Harrison said it best. He said when David Bowie came with his tapes to Apple, they turned him down. And I think David Bowie got pretty famous after that. So they made some major mistakes down the road. And I think when you try to do business and rock and roll, when you're songwriters, and like John brought up a good point, you would see a lot with time of Let It Be, they were disintegrating.
Yeah. It's also didn't help anything that Charles Manson said that he was getting all of these subliminal type messages from their music, and that the White Album was full of all these messages that he was receiving about the end of the world and race wars and all this kind of stuff. I mean, a lot of people it's like water off a duck's back, but there was also this really dark side of that, you know, where people were thinking, you know, here's this man that introduced this mass murdering person, this cult, that he was listening to Helter Skelter, and he was listening to the Beatles.
Well, there's a point on this too, John. During the trial, a lot of people don't know this, Paul and John Lennon testified during his trial saying that that song had nothing to do with what is on in his warped mind. And they said all we was trying to do to show the Who, we was still a strong rock and roll band. But then again, Manson tried to turn that into a revolutionary thing. And I saw that movie, Helter Skelter, and they played that in the beginning of that. And that is one creepy movie, I'll tell you that. And what the Tate, Sharon Tate things and stuff. And it's a shame that song always has to be mentioned with that, but it's always going to be, and that's what makes it the way it is.
Yeah, what do you think, John, about that? I mean, we've talked about all the different aspects of what was affecting the Beatles at that time with their Apple Corps and with Yoko and with all the different things happening. What do you think where does that fit into this, the Charles Manson? Oh, yeah, I was getting all these messages from the Beatles.
I think it was kind of a reflection of the Beatles' popularity to the point that not only did they have a mass following, but unfortunately a mass following means everybody of every type of psyche starts to follow you, and you have to live with that even though you have no control of it. I mean, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of people who were in the real of law enforcement were Beatle fans, but there was probably a lot of criminals that were Beatle fans. And unfortunately, Manson has tainted the song Helter Skelter. It's a great rock and roller, but anybody that knows history and that what was going on at the time, you can't help but think of that underlying tone. And when the Beatles had absolutely nothing to do with it, and, you know, from what I read, it was about a fairgrounds, like an amusement park or something. That's one quick.
It was a roller coaster in England.
That's what it was. Okay.
Yeah.
And as Dave said, Paul's response to Peter Townsend's comment and in the Melody Maker that we're the only ones making really loud rock and roll anymore. And so McCartney's like, okay, so you think so, huh? Well, let you hear this.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was incredible. And that's one thing about the White Album that, you know, I was making a point earlier, like you were saying, John and David, when you introduce it to young people and they're listening, and a lot of albums all kind of fit together. Even Sgt. Pepper fit together. Even a lot of those albums fit together. But this one was so different. It was like having all these different albums all thrown together. You've got all this incredible music. You have Julia, which we talked about a little bit. And you have all these beautiful songs. Then you have these rocking songs. Then you have these creepy songs. You have every kind of thing going on. And it's like still to this day, it can satisfy the most incredible cravings that anyone would have for creative music. You can find it right there in that album.
I got a question once, John. We was doing a show down in the Carolinas, one of our trivia shows. And sometimes John and I will take questions from the audience before the show starts, and we'll do that. One of the questions I got, they said if I could only take three albums with me, and John, you remember this, remember I told them I would take Big White because I said there's so much different things the Beatles had done on that, and I always have, because it is the way it is, I said it was so different. You had every style of music, like you brought up JD on stuff, and you've seen how talented they all were. And but then again, the sad part, like I told Mike when he called in, you also could see down the road, they were starting to go to their individual styles, too. It was just a matter of time.
Absolutely.
You know, we were talking earlier about Obladi Oblada. I'm sorry, John. But Obladi Oblada. And even though that was a Paul McCartney song, we said, can you imagine what John Lennon's face was like? I said, okay, let's try this song. At times, though, it was bringing them together. I read a story that when John first heard about it, it was like, oh, my gosh, this is ridiculous. He goes, I can't even stay. And he left. And now this is what it said in the article. It said then he got a little high on some marijuana, and he came back, and he said, I'll tell you what, if you let me speed up as far as the tempo, I can make this song even better, and Paul agreed to it. So even on a song he didn't like, he found a way to that he could work, and they could work together, that they would collaborate.
Well, they were more like brothers when it comes down to it. Brothers will have their arguments, but I like when Paul said it best on an interview not that long ago. He said John was more like that brother to me. He said, all brothers have arguments and stuff. And John asked me a question, JD, it was very interesting, about Paul can never whistle real good. Well, John was a natural whistler. John, remember we talked about this the other day, and how John Lennon could whistle in songs, and Paul wanted him to whistle in that, remember, on Blackbird.
Mm-hmm.
And he would do that.
Well, that's cool. Well, we've got just about 6 minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit about George Harrison and George Harrison's contribution. And our last song tonight is going to be While My Guitar Gently Weeps. If you guys could just take this couple of minutes here to kind of build that up, talk about George Harrison. I love what he did after the Beatles. I think his music just got better and better, and I think he was like – waiting for people to hear his real talent. And what do you guys think that where George fits in this White Album?
I myself, and I'll let John talk. I think we're starting to see the talent George Harrison really had. All along, everybody knew he was a great guitar player and stuff, but his songwriting ability was starting to show. After My Car Gently Weeps, we know he's going to write the song Something down the road. He's already writing some of the songs would be on his solo album, All Things Must Pass, but we see how talented, not only as a guitar player, his musical writing ability, and how great a singer he was, but like I said, there was so much talent in that band, but I think that's the main thing I want to point out on George.
How about you, John?
I think George's role in the White Album and his biggest influence is why it was two albums. I think by the time it got to the White Album, John and Paul had realized, hey, he's a pretty good songwriter himself. We just can't do one album here, and we need to fit these in. And I think that's the biggest compliment that could be given, because I think without George, it would have just been another single album. I think that that was the first time that, in my opinion, Lennon and McCartney really realized that he was nearly, maybe not equal, but sure approaching their writing ability, that he could come up with some really good contributions.
Yeah, and as David said, All Things Must Pass is just absolutely amazing album. I mean, it's just incredible. Well, guys, it's been, again, a really wonderful time having you on. I really appreciate you being on. We're going to have part two. I'll get that scheduled. We got just a couple minutes. What would you like to say in closing? Let's start off with David.
Oh, it goes too fast, John. I really enjoy doing this. And anytime I can talk about the Beatles, they're iconic, and I enjoy every second and always enjoy being on your program with you, John. And I just got to say this again. It's great, all the shows we've done together, and always having a good time.
Thank you. John?
John, I just want to say thanks again for giving us the opportunity to be guests on your show. We really enjoy this. It's that time of the year where we get out and about in some campuses doing Parents Family Day weekend shows, so it's fall's always exciting time for us to have that going on. And the last thing I say about the White Album, until we get to part two, was that we're talking about how it changed everything every time the Beatles were a step above. And it's like, okay, what do we do? Even George Martin, when they came back with these 40-some songs, even he was overwhelmed, because suddenly he said, I wasn't working with four men in one studio. Now I was working in three studios, and I was only one of me.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, he had to be totally overwhelmed with this music coming out. Well, guys,
yes.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank all the listeners that have been supporting John Talk Radio. November will be our 10th year. We'll be going into our next year. And we really appreciate you guys being a part of it, John and David. And the listeners out there, thank you so much. We just love talking rock and roll. We're going to keep doing it until we stop. So thank you. And this is The Beatles, While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Everybody have a great evening.
Told you they bought and sold.